Welcome to Manufacturing Talk Radio, the only show that takes a look at the obstacles and opportunities open to small to mid-sized enterprises that manufacture here in America. Brought to you by All Metals and Forge Group, with your hosts, Tim Grady and Lou Wise.
Welcome, everyone, to Blog Talk Radio. Lou, how are you today?
Good, good. I'm surviving the non-snowstorm. And by the way, this is Manufacturing Talk Radio, running on Blog Talk Radio. So we did survive the snowstorm. We were supposed to have 20 to 30 inches. We wound up with 6 to 8. We had a shutdown of all the bridges, the tunnels, the subways, and the buses in New York City. It looked like the day after New Year's Eve, from what I saw on television. So we're doing okay. How you doing, Tim?
Good. Fortunately, I'm down here in Atlanta with much milder weather, so it's a little easier for us. We're actually waiting to get our first snowstorm because it's an unusual occurrence, even with climate change, I guess, as they call it these days. So we haven't gotten that yet, but we'll wait patiently. And in the meantime, I'd like everybody to know that we're still struggling with the L.A. ports. Lou, you've got the latest update. What's going on with our lovely ports in Los Angeles?
Nothing. There is nothing going on. The latest this morning, I heard that there are 16 ships anchored off of Los Angeles and Long Beach. It seems as though that they are having negotiations, and I think the headline was that we've made some major strides in reaching a tentative agreement. It has something to do with fixing the chassis for the trucks. However, the topics that they haven't touched on yet is healthcare, unresolved wages, pension, work rules, jurisdiction, you know, all those minor things that are holding up our port. This has been going on for 9 months, and it doesn't seem as though that the federal mediator has any weight whatsoever. He must be a Obama man. Nothing's going on. I know that most of the public doesn't really know anything about it. I did hear that Sears on the radio the other day, they were talking about the fact that they are running out of inventory. Must have something to do with their imports. Walmart also is having similar problems. Only the largest retailer in the United States doesn't have inventory. So I don't know why the news media has chosen not to pick up on this. It may have something to do with taking instructions from the big White House in Washington. But I won't be too cynical about it. The other, of course, is the snowstorm that we had yesterday here in New York that shut down almost everything. Actually, I came to the studio this morning in spite of the state of emergency on the highways. New Jersey highways were foreboding. I was one of the only cars, plus two police cars and a tow truck that I saw. But the show must go on, so here we are. Tim?
Well, we'll be touching a little bit on global supply chains today because we have the pleasure of having Cliff Waldman back on the show. Cliff is the Director of Economic Studies at the MAPI Foundation. That's the Manufacturers Alliance for Productivity and Innovation. And he has an interesting take on Made in the USA. So we'll be chatting with Cliff. Cliff, how are you today?
I'm fine, thank you.
Great, great. Cliff, Made in the USA, that recently appeared on MAPI.net, and you and I had a discussion about it, and I wanted to invite you back on the show. But it said, Made in the USA? Can you explain that to our listeners?
Well, first of all, it's my pleasure to be back. Thank you for inviting me once again. Second of all, Made in the USA is a paradigm that, you know, repeats itself every so often, particularly at times of economic stress. And I wrote the blog and the blog title in that fashion with a question mark because I wanted to make a distinction about how things have changed over time. In the 1980s, as I said in the blog, competition, global competition, was a very emotional topic for the American people. The strength of the Japanese automakers was considered an affront to an important industry for the United States, and it was sort of seen as being something that was challenging our economic hegemony, our economic way of life. These days, there seems to be less of that. You would think that if that emotion carried over, then the American public would be very worried about China and India. But I think you see less of it. And that's because I think there is a growing awareness of the true nature of global integration, particularly in the wake of the 2008 crisis, where we understand that strength in one area of the world can matter to strength in other areas of the world. So we have a little bit more of a collaborative view of economic activity and of the fact that the U.S. is not an island and can't be an island in an increasingly integrated global economy.
Well, I would absolutely agree with you there, yes. It is a global economy, and I think the U.S. should choose to be a leader in it. I think we have in many ways. Of course, the L.A. port situation isn't helping global supply chains any. Cliff, when you're talking about this subject, one of the things that comes up is, in fact, global supply chains. What's the impact?
Well, global supply chains are sort of the mechanism through which, you know, a truly global manufacturing sector is taking place. More and more, the world is dividing its goods production efficiently. We know that the industrialized advanced nations are not going to make commoditized products. They're going to go to labor-intensive areas where they just simply make more sense. On the other end, innovation is going to go to where innovation ecosystems are developed. But for the advanced products, the high-tech or high R&D machines that the advanced economies, including the United States, make, we know that certain countries have comparative advantages in certain parts of the supply chain. So you'll very often find that one product, particularly one complex or one motor, one new technology, can often be produced across a myriad of countries. And that means that the thinking on the impact of that is that the national thinking on what competition means has to change dramatically. We don't think of it as a head-to-head fight of one country versus the other, but the effort of one country to maximize its place in the emerging world of global supply chains.
And you've made the point of it's not us versus them, it's us and them, which I think is a good point.
Yes, there's a little subtlety I want to surround there. I mean, we do have to worry about, in order to maximize our place in global supply chains, we do have to worry about competitiveness. We do have to worry about the fact that we still have a trade deficit, which means we're not selling enough exports. We do have to worry about we do have to rejoice in some good things are happening with our labor costs corrected for productivity being internationally competitive, our energy situation being much better, much more competitive. But again, the object, so we have to play the competition game, but the object of the game is not so much for the U.S. auto industry to beat the Japanese auto industry, as was the case in the 1980s, but to get our slice, maximize our interest within the context of a world of growing global supply chains.
Well, you make a good point about Japan. You know, I hearken back to the movie Back to the Future when Marty McFly goes back to the 1950s and meets Doc Brown, and one of the parts fails, and Doc Brown says, well, no wonder it failed. It's made in Japan. And Marty says, what are you talking about? All the great stuff is made in Japan. Did Japan overcome Made in Japan by delivering top quality cars and electronics to the U.S.?
Well, it did what it did very well. I mean, Japan succeeded at the time it was successful by focusing on its own particular genius, which first of all is process innovation. And really, they taught the world about the nature of process efficiency and process innovation. I think they made a number of mistakes. They ignored the long-term consequences of a bursting bubble, and I think even longer term than that, they failed to see, you know, the rise of Asia as a labor-intensive huge region of the world with potentially tremendous implications. But yes, I think Japan, when it succeeded, it did what it did very well. It focused on its own knitting, which is process innovation, but it was short-sighted in other ways, and it's still working to overcome that.
Oh, it clearly is. Japan is really struggling as an economy. When you talk about global supply chains, and I know that we're talking about parts, components, and labor, who's going to be the leader, China or India?
Well, I don't know that as things evolve, I don't know that you're necessarily going to have a leader. I think you're going to have it's a team kind of thing, and who's going to do what is the better question mark. But let me sort of bring up one, you know, tangential issue that's actually more than just tangential to that. As global supply chains evolve, supply chain efficiency, time to market, that kind of things becomes all the more important for all countries who are participating in these global supply chains. And that brings in the growing importance of these disruptive technologies that you hear about almost every day. 3D printing, for example, is one. And I think for the United States, which has innovated so many of these technologies, I mean, 3D printing, you know, the experiments for 3D printing began in the United States in 1960. One of the things we are going to have to do to maximize our place in this new world of growing global supply chains is that we're going to have to sort of not give away the store on the economic value of our own disruptive innovations. We've gained some value from innovating 3D, but we want to keep, there'll be upgrades, there'll be 3D 2.0, 3.0. We don't want to give away that sort of thing. So in this growing world of global supply chain innovations, we have to realize how it's motivating manufacturing to change, how that in turn motivated technological innovations. And since the U.S. has done so much good work in that area, for us as a policy, I think I would like to see not just so much a policy, but a strategy for us to keep the value of the new technologies, which are really feeding and facilitating the stresses and the requirements of living in a global supply chain world.
Going back a point, Cliff, about Made in USA, the Buy American Act, which goes back a number of years, actually wound up ticking off a lot of our friends and our allies, particularly in Europe, where the us versus them, clearly it was, the Buy American Act is us and forget about them. NATO got all bent out of shape over the issue, and they said, you know, we're friends, you know, how about us? Why aren't we participating in these issues, government contracts and so on and so forth? So the altered the Buy American Act to also include the NATO nations. So now Buy American means buy in America, Germany, England, France, Italy, you know, and so on and so forth. So the Buy American has been kind of clouded due to international political issues, and that's been going on now for a number of years. And now they have the DFARS laws, which says that you can produce overseas, call it American made, as long as 60% of content is American. Well, then you start having a cloudy issue about what's 60%? 60% material, 60% labor. It becomes a very cloudy issue. And,
yes, it does.
And I think it's becoming more of us and them instead of us versus them, which is your point.
I think that's correct, yes. I don't want to comment on the politics of all that, because they are difficult international politics. But the cloudiness, you know, speaks to the issue in physical and economic terms. You know, a lot of American imports of goods have been normally thought as being sort of an affront to manufacturing stability. And certainly we want to export more. We do need to work on exporting more. But imports often have large American content. In some industries, imports are tied to American jobs. So yes, all of that. Well, again, I won't comment on the international politics of that fight. I will say that the structure of the argument speaks to the structure of evolving global supply networks.
Cliff, is there anything, you know, we're talking really to the manufacturers out in America and around the globe who are listening to the show, but also to the American consumer or other consumers, but on this topic, is there anything that the American consumer should be concerned about, or are these products so integrated and tested these days that, you know, Made in America is a label, but what's underlying that is really a well-built consumer product or industrial product?
I'm going to give you a slightly different answer than perhaps is often given on that. You know,
okay.
Another thing that we want to think about in terms of maximizing our own strength in this different and evolving integrated world is that, you know, we want to see more entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship has been weak in the United States for 15, 20 years now, and it's been, you know, weak concomitantly in the manufacturing sector. Fortunately, for a while, manufacturing plant startups were falling. Fortunately, they have leveled off. So we see, you know, another good point that perhaps we're seeing a little bit more of us sort of reaching a little bit more of our potential in the manufacturing integrated world. But we clearly need, both in manufacturing and non-manufacturing, more business startups. It's been a weakness that's, you know, well predated the Great Recession, and it's one of the reasons we had a weak labor market recovery. And, you know, if we're worried about the future of our manufacturing sector, we need more manufacturing startups. So, you know, I'm seeing efforts in the news lately, for example, to get teenagers more interested in entrepreneurship. I think that's a great idea. I think the American consumer, the American public, has to think about, hey, you know, that's one route for me to get ahead and for us to get ahead. So we need more business startups. That will make a difference in our strength and our place in this growing global team that I'm talking about.
Well, Cliff, about new startups and entrepreneurship, it might help if we had some help and incentives from Washington, my new favorite target, for them to assist and aid, and also looking to the banking industry to divest some of the billions that they're making into small loans to small startups and help in creating what you're talking about. But nobody's really doing that, and you don't hear anything about it.
Sure. Support of that kind is important. I agree with you that we need more of it. But I think there's a kind of an interesting complexity that is growing both out of the economics thinking and out of the efforts that are going on in the states. The states are important policy arenas. We have to pay as close attention to what's going on in key states, in fact, in all states, as we are in Washington. And one of the things that is states are efforting to do in certain parts of the country is to create something called clusters. Which, you know, regional, we think of a national economy, but it's really made up of many regional economies, which have different advantages, different strengths, different weaknesses. And a cluster is either naturally evolving or evolving by policy fiat, and it's an effort to sort of leverage the strength of that region. And then once you do that, I mean, you know, I'd like to see advanced manufacturing clusters sort of grow into key regions where they are not. And then, you know, the states can work together, and then you see how the parts fit into each other much more easily in regions than you do in states. Than you do in the national economy. You'll see how workforce development fits in with entrepreneurship, fits in with, you know, a strategic use of 3D and other new technologies. So I think one of the things that it's been demonstrated to help entrepreneurship is to create strong regional clusters, and that almost automatically helps business startups, because then it makes sense to start a business in a region where there's other businesses, where there's, you know, support, quasi-governmental support, governmental support, technological infrastructure. So I agree with you about the banking industry and about the federal government, but the states have to create, you know, leverage the strengths of their the peculiar strengths of their regional economies, and in doing so, we know that will help entrepreneurship development and business startup activity.
The only thing that I've seen in terms of state involvement at any kind of level of developing business, take for example the state of New York. They started a program of stealing industries from one state to another. New York State went on this program this past year, and they brought in 33 major corporations to move to the state of New York. And they're giving them tax incentives, I should say tax gifts, no taxes for 20 years and so on. But I haven't personally seen what you're talking about. So if in fact that's happening, I'd like to see where that, you know, for the understanding of our listeners, where are these clusters and or incubators developing?
Well, one interesting one, and I'll speak from experience. I did a paper on the development of an advanced manufacturing cluster in the South. The South is promising, perhaps, if they make some changes, for Southeast, that is, for the development of an advanced manufacturing cluster, and they are beginning to talk about it quite seriously. So we might see something there. We know Silicon Valley. I mean, Silicon Valley is the ultimate cluster. We know the Research Triangle. You know, we need to see more of it. We see some clustering activity in a little bit of New Jersey and San Diego. Yes, I mean, it needs to get off the ground. But I think there is having been a researcher for supporting a discussion of advanced manufacturing clusters in the South, I know the states are beginning to realize it. And what clusters are exactly not what you just said. They're not tax incentives that, you know, pivot capital from one state to another. They're cooperative efforts to use the strengths of one state, the strengths of another state, to create a different entity that leverages, the strengths of each of its components. There is some activity, and there is at least some discussion along these lines, and I think it's going to go forward. I think you will see more of it.
Cliff, why don't we take a quick commercial break here, and we'll be back in just a few moments with Manufacturing Talk Radio.
Okay.
Manufacturing Talk Radio will be right back.
All Metals and Forge Group manufactures open die forgings in blocks, hubs, shafts, flanges, cylinders, gear blanks, and custom forge shapes, including seamless rolled rings in alloy, carbon, stainless and tool steels, aluminum, nickel alloys, copper and titanium for parts and assemblies in aerospace, oil and gas exploration, defense, machinery, transportation, shipbuilding, energy and power, pulp and paper, and many other industries. Visit steelforge.com or call 800-600-9290.
Welcome back to Manufacturing Talk Radio.
Before we continue with Cliff, I did want to mention last week's show, which I normally do at the beginning of our show. for our listeners who didn't listen last week, we were talking about wacky labels in regards to manufacturers and about frivolous lawsuits and class action suits. And we had a gentleman on the show, Bob DiGerio.
Jones.
Rather humorous fellow, and introduced some really wacky stories about wacky labels. I think it would be interesting for you folks to get a little bit of a chuckle, and it is about manufacturing, but it's from a very odd point. So listen to our show last week, and Tim, let's deal with today's show.
We're back with Cliff Waldman. And Cliff, I wanted to bring up to you this reshoring discussion. We have had several people on the show talking about reshoring, and that this job seemed to be coming back to America. I'm recently reading where that may or may not be the case. The bigger question is, as we reach this global supply chain equilibrium, is reshoring that big a deal?
Well, I think you have to put it in the proper context. I think it depends on whether you're looking at it from a national point of view or from a local point of view. From a national point of view, probably not, in the sense that, yes, we probably are bringing some jobs back, and you hear some high-level announcements of it from large corporations. But we're probably also, you have to look at net flows. We're probably also sending some jobs away as goods production becomes efficiently distributed over time throughout the global economy. However, if you are a community that depends on that plant, and the economic development benefits of a factory are well established in the economics literature, but if you're a community, or even a city, it's a heck of a big deal. So I think the answer to that depends on the perspective. Nationally, in a dynamic global economy for a large country like the United States, probably not. We have coming, we have going. For a small community, for a city even, big deal. So perspective matters here.
In regards to what Tim was talking about, reshoring, tell us a little bit, if this falls into your expertise, about nearshoring, namely Mexico. I hear a lot of things going on down there.
Well, Mexico is a place of great promise and great turmoil. We have an excellent Latin American consultant, Fernando Sedano, who certainly has more detailed knowledge than I do of it. But I know Mexico is a place of great interest for obvious reasons. It fits very well in terms of proximity and logistics. It's got a workforce which has a good reputation. It also has some real very serious challenges. The drug cartels, violence, which you think is solved one week and then isn't the next week. So those are big issues for inward direct investment. It's ties to NAFTA and its auto industry and the fact that it exports to the U.S. And some to Canada. So I would say Mexico is a great area of turmoil, but you have to be aware of both the benefit of the strengths and the risks and the socioeconomic problems down there. So Mexico, U.S. manufacturers are not going to stop going to Mexico, but I think an awareness of where it is and where it isn't matters.
Now, Cliff, back in October, you were writing about durables, and we're talking about global supply chains and made in the USA. Have durables gained some strength over the last 90 days?
I'm sorry, has what?
Have durable goods gained some strength over the last 90 days?
No, well, I mean, listen, I wrote a commentary on the durable goods, orders this morning. No, in fact, they weakened. We had a very disturbing durable goods report this morning. They give you the latest data for December, and they give you a few months back, and we are seeing weakness in durable goods, and particularly, there's one component of the report. It's, orders for non-defense capital goods, excluding aircraft, which are so large that they move the number around considerably. That's taken as a proxy for business equipment spending, and that's what you want to gauge. How business investment, and we're seeing that as being weak. It's been down for 3 months. So, You know, that's been a salient feature of the post-2009 rebound, is just, and really the post-2000 world, is weak business investment. So, no, I don't see durable strengthening. In fact, the fourth quarter was a particularly weak one for durable goods demand.
So when we're talking about, the recovery of manufacturing in the United States, and we're really seeing that in the smaller plant operations, the 100 to 400 employee plant operations, it seems to me that may be the only place that this investment is taking place. Is that consistent with what you're saying, Cliff?
It's hard to break the data down, you know, to that level of granularity. Manufacturing, when the economy hit bottom in 2009, manufacturing came out of the gate faster than the economy as a whole because, emerging markets at that time had a faster rebound, and also we had a very sharp inventory turn, which benefits factories. But then manufacturing started getting pulled into the problems of the world. And while we've had very volatile manufacturing growth, it's strong one quarter, not strong another. I think there's probably moderate growth. Abstracting from all the the ups and downs, there's probably moderate growth in manufacturing, but with a somewhat of a downside risk because the problems of the world, you know, can't help but impinge upon manufacturing growth in the U.S. And I think we saw that in the durable goods report this morning. Business decision makers are facing, certainly a better U.S. economy, but they're also facing great weakness in the world economy, which matters to them. And in particular, that's been translating into turmoil in a lot of key markets: oil, equities, currencies, and that has a negative impact on the confidence of business decision makers to invest, and that and expand and buy capital equipment, and that showed up pretty clearly in this morning's durables report. It was not. This has not been a good 2 or 3 months for durables demand.
Go ahead, Lou.
I was just going to comment on the oil and gas sector. It's great to have $1.75 gas at the pump, but $40-$50 a barrel is not necessarily good for manufacturing, and certainly not good for the oil and gas industry. We now have a glut, an oil glut, and I heard several major corporations last week laying off thousands of people from the oil and gas industry because the price of oil per barrel is not high enough for them to cover costs, no less make a profit. This could be a major deterrent here in the U.S. economy.
Well, you know, it's interesting how markets sort of reveal things. You know, at first, when oil started falling, it was a bit of a head-scratcher because, I mean, lower oil prices should and I think eventually will have great benefits. It is lower prices at the pump. It does give the consumer more, more money to spend in other places and therefore juice the economy. Remember, the economy is still 70% consumer. So we were wondering why, when oil was falling, was the stock market taking it as such a negative? And we have to realize that, one consequence of the very, very good energy supply expansion, the very positive energy supply expansion, is that when oil prices go the other way, they matter more to the economy now these days. Now, falling oil is a good thing. But oil falling as fast as it was, first of all, when you see any market falling as fast as it was, you worry about stability. It's not so much that lower prices are bad. They're not. But when it falls, it's the rate of change of the downward increase that makes you worry about a kind of a general sense of stability, particularly in these post-2008 years. And also, you have to remember that a lot of banks were invested in this energy supply expansion. And that, that creates fears of financial stability. I think some of this is correct. I think some of this is still the kind of jitters that, the residual jitters that we've had from the 2008-2009 recession, the financial break that precipitated that. I think eventually oil will find its point, will stabilize, and we'll see oil prices as being a general positive for the U.S. economy and other economies. It'll be a general positive for the Eurozone economy, but right now, the rate of decline has been so speedy that we're worried about stability and we're worried about financial issues. And, you know, the fact that other commodities are joining the oil fall for certain countries and for certain companies, that's pressure. You know, it was interesting to see Canada actually lower interest rates because of the oil decline. When's the last time we ever saw that? Oil prices are falling, and a major central bank lowers interest rates. Well, you have to remember, Canada is a commodities exporter. So, you know, if this is putting a lot of pressure on its already somewhat weak economy, the Canadian economy recently has been helped a little bit by, at least moderate U.S. manufacturing growth. But it depends a lot on commodities, so it's been kind of a rough time. I think this will all find the bottom, will all find an equilibrium, but you have to remember the calculus of energy in terms of its role in the U.S. economy and therefore its role in the U.S. stock market has changed fairly dramatically, and markets are showing that to us.
So, Cliff, here's the gotcha question. Where should oil price be that makes everybody happy?
You know what? It's gotten as low as – you have to remember something. Spot markets are wonderful things in that they create transparency. Nobody can say, hey, I'm going to sell you a barrel of oil for $100 or sell you a barrel of oil for $2, because the spot market kind of disciplines commercial activity. But you also have to remember that spot markets are – partially financial markets in the sense that they – and that means that they tend to move around just for emotional reasons because of political events of the day. So there's part rationality in the pricing of oil and part irrationality. Now, you know, at one point the oil got as low as $10. I doubt it's going to get that low these days, although if the fears about the globe continue, it might. I don't think that's an equilibrium price. I'm going to take a guess of, you know, $30 to $40 is probably where the bottom, you know, in the 30s, because we've seen that fairly recently. I think in the 30s is probably where it is, and then once, you know, the world equilibrates and stabilizes, I think it'll probably build a little up from the 30s. That's my guess.
I'm not happy. I'd like to see about $60, $70. Because the more oil they pump, the more forgings they buy, and that's our primary business.
Right. I understand.
Now, Cliff, at the Manufacturers Alliance for Productivity and Innovation, are you predominantly dealing with the big OEMs, or are you also dealing with the small and mid-sized enterprises?
We have a nice mixture of some larger companies, companies in the mid-sized $1 to $5 billion range. We have a few smaller ones. I would say we have a pretty good size distribution, which I enjoy because it gives you a somewhat smaller company perspective. It gives you the large behemoth perspective that you really sort of can learn something about the true mechanisms of global supply chain. So the answer is both. We have a pretty good pretty wide distribution.
And do you see the small and mid-sized enterprises being more involved in sourcing goods from overseas, or is it really the behemoths that are involved?
No, everybody. Now sourcing is a specific expertise. Our chief economist, Dan Mexroth, runs our purchasing council, so he has it a lot better than I do. But I don't think there's any distinction there. But, Dr. Mexroth runs our purchasing group, and he has for many years now, and he has a more specific knowledge of sourcing than I do.
Okay. Now, this article that you found interesting and provocative in the Wall Street Journal about Made in the USA, those two reporters were talking about Made in the USA, you know, moving slowly back to that production status, and you're really taking a counterpoint to that. Where do you see this all in 20 years? Does it, you know, it used to be, gee, my competitor is in Iowa and I'm in Wisconsin. Now our competitor may be halfway around the globe. But does this all hit a point of equilibrium sometime out in the future?
Well, I think yes and no. I think in terms of distribution, it will. I think, but remember, you know, other interesting things are happening. We may see the rise of Africa. Who knows what Cuba is mm-hmm. going to do now that you know it seems to be a different day for it. Nonetheless, I think the answer is yes, but you have to remember that along with this evolution of the distribution of manufacturing around the world vis-a-vis these integrated global supply chains, I'll come back to an earlier point and say that the nature of what manufacturing is, what it can do, is changing so dramatically with these disruptive innovations, with 3D printing, with smart manufacturing, with digital technology. So the nature of the manufacturing enterprise is going to play into the answer to your question, and frankly, it makes it all the more unpredictable.
Now, you had just done or are doing a paper on 3D printing. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm working on an article on 3D printing. Correct.
Is there anything in there, Cliff, because it's one of my curiosity questions, what the impact of 3D printing is going to be on manual labor?
It depends on the industry. I don't think it's going to have huge impacts on manual labor, at least for a long time. Right now, it's really a design mechanism. It's for prototyping, for trying new things. It can have production impacts. I'm finding more, just in informal discussions at NAPI events, that more and more people are moving it into production. I think, for example, in aerospace, it might be become... a producer of airplane parts over time. That technology is hitting the world in interesting ways, but it too is going to change. It's going to upgrade. Just like software doesn't stand still, 3D printing will not stand still either. So I don't think initially it's going to have huge impacts on manual labor, but I do think over time you're going to see, the nature of what manufacturing does, where you can build part, it's going to shorten supply chains. You can produce parts closer to the source. You can work with your customers on designing new products because 3D printing makes that a much faster, more efficient. R&D will become more integrated into the global into the supply chain as opposed to being a kind of back office light bulb function, because you can show the immediate impacts of new design changes with 3D printing. No impact, I don't think, not huge impacts, at least, on labor, but that could be coming down the line in certain industries.
Now, you and I talked prior to the show about a week ago about the U.S. selling off, or a company really selling off its technology, and I liken back to the VCR, which we created in the U.S., and then we sold
right.
to Philips in the Netherlands, and then they did quite well with it. 3D printing is one that runs that risk. How great a risk do you think that is, or are we learning from past mistakes?
Well, I don't know whether we're learning from past mistakes. I think we have to realize that, listen, we innovated 3D printing here. The initial experiments began in the 1960s. And, the U.S. has a proud record of disruptive innovation. But, we have to make sure that we keep the economic value of the upgrades, of the of the less dramatic things, the upgrades, the changes. Now, are we learning from that? I don't know. But I will comment that, once again, a cluster, if clusters take off in the States as competitive tools, I think it'll help, because then everything fits into into a piece of the cluster, including new technologies. If we do that, if we leverage regional economies and put 3D printing into their proper place in different regional economies, that will help us to maintain the ongoing value of these new technologies. So I think the jury is still out on whether we've learned the lesson or not. I'm not sure. I hope we have.
Okay. And in terms of these clusters that you have mentioned several times in today's show, how do you see those working? And do you have examples of those working? To me, it seems disjointed, although we've talked to people from universities who'd like to be involved, and we've heard from state associations that would like to be involved, but we don't see what you, for instance, see in China. They have whole cities that are devoted to
yes.
one thing, and another city that's devoted to something else. How do we get that kind of thing actually going in the U.S.?
Well, we have to have cooperation among states. I mean, the states are the subunits for economic activity, and we have to have strong state relationships. Then we have to recognize what this, for any given region, what the strength and weakness of each state is. And okay, so Alabama doesn't have a strong workforce, but it does have cheap land prices. And Georgia does have a strong workforce, but it doesn't have enough. It doesn't have enough of this. Okay, how can Alabama and Georgia sort of combine to create, where they use the workforce strength of one, but the land price strength of the other? There's no one formula for it, but the common sense notion of using it, of recognizing advantages and disadvantages of states within a region and cooperating to capitalize on all that is the beginning of a cluster. And again, if you want to pick a picture of one in your mind, the ultimate cluster is Silicon Valley. I mean, that's the cluster of clusters in the Research Triangle also in some ways. It's the beginning of it. To make it happen, states have to recognize the value of it, and they have to have strong relationship with each other, and then careful planning to say, to leverage the particular strength of each state and recognize the weaknesses of each state in the region and then use them effectively.
And do you see this being led by the states, or do you see it being led by industry,
I see it being led by the states with some initial investment from the federal government. That's the ultimate. It should be led and efforted by the states with perhaps an investment from the federal government.
Okay, and does that give us some renewed strength for Made in the USA, because these are really innovation clusters that we're trying to develop?
Well, yes, it can. It means that, we want to, for example, the Cube opening, which I just put out a paper on, it should be on the MAPI website either now or soon, that creates an opportunity. I mean, Cuba is a country of 11 million people. It's not a small market for certain industries. And I think the Southeast cluster, if one evolves, can make itself peculiarly competitive to take advantage of the Cuba opening for new markets, for new demand.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned the Southeast, because I am in the Southeast, and I'm seeing a lot of things here that are evolving that people would not have expected. For instance, there are something like 15 sound stages already built in the Atlanta area, another 15 under construction, and another 20 planned. That's almost more than there is in Los Angeles. So Atlanta's becoming the new Hollywood.
Oh, absolutely.
I expect to see more of that in industry, because the governor of Georgia is very aggressive about attracting people to Georgia. BMW is now moving their headquarters here. But those are all individual but not integrated efforts.
Indeed.
Additionally, the aerospace industry, talking about California, is also beginning to trek their way east and south. They're moving into Mexico. They're moving into Georgia and South Carolina and Georgia. And now with the port issue happening in California, it's going to come to a point where the last one leaving L.A. is going to have to turn the lights out, because there is a lot of industry. And we did look into this several months ago about material supply chain in regards to the Southeast, about metal manufacturing is growing also in the Southwest to support metalworking and metalworking industry, namely aerospace. So this is just another sign of clustering in a whole region.
The capability of doing it. I think if the states begin to realize it, if the governors begin to realize even the political benefits of it, I think we are well positioned to do it. I mean, listen, this is the largest, most diverse economy in the world. If ever there's an economy that can benefit from efficient and well thought out clustering, it's us. We just have to want to do it. The capability is there, and the opportunities are there. It's just a matter of people understanding the concept. And I can tell you, they are beginning, having done research for them, they are beginning to think very seriously about it in the Southeast.
Well, Cliff, you brought up Cuba, and Cuba has always been a fascination of mine. We've responded more slowly to Cuba than I thought in terms of normalizing relations. But now that that's beginning to come together, what are the opportunities for manufacturing in Cuba? Can we move some manufacturing activities off to Cuba and import for there? We only have to go 90 miles.
Well, Cuba has, in its long journey ahead, has very definite strengths, very definite weaknesses. It has an educated population, but it also has a rapidly aging population. In terms of manufacturing, it needs to get its macroeconomic fundamentals a little stronger for manufacturing. Investment as a share, you know, capital investment as a share of GDP is too weak. 10%, a little over 10%. That is too weak for a developing economy that wants to build a manufacturing sector. But even there are some pockets of light even in manufacturing. Cuba has a strong pharmaceutical industry, a strong biotech industry, and that shows that could be a touching point in that it shows their capacity to innovate. So I mean, if they can innovate in one area, they can innovate in another. But they have to start by getting the macro fundamentals right, and they need a program for immigration and family planning, because while they have done a good job of investing in education and you know, keeping enrollment and attainment high, it has one of the highest attainment rates of education years in Latin America and the Caribbean. It really, really needs to get stronger investment, and it really needs an immigration policy, because it's aging much faster than Latin America and the Caribbean, and that's a problem for workforce and for the household demand that you need for a healthy goods demand. It's got strengths. It's got weaknesses. I don't think many people realize that it has a strong pharmaceuticals industry. If they did that, they could do other things in manufacturing.
Mm-hmm. Economically, they're going to have to. You know, which comes first, the chicken or the egg? Do they build businesses and industries so that people don't want to leave, and not only leave but have people come back? Therefore, improving the workforce age issue. So this is something that they really need to look at in terms of, again, which came first, the chicken or the egg.
True. Well, another thing that they have done on the positive side along those lines is that they have a healthy entrepreneurial sector. I don't think a lot of people realize that their business startup activity has greatly improved since roughly 2008, when Raul Castro came to the presidency. That could be, if they really build on that, that could be incentives for, pulling in an immigrant population that may see in this new day the possibilities of their own business. So, that could be, leverage to help with the population situation.
Cliff, you have mentioned aging populations in a couple of countries around the world, ours being one of them, where we have a concern, but you also mentioned Germany. So what are the issues with aging population as we look around the world in this made in the USA and global supply chains that some countries are not planning for?
Yes, no, but listen, the industrialized world, the U.S. right now is in a pretty good position, because while our fertility rate is right on the line in terms of population replacement, which is 2.1, we are benefiting from a strong immigration policy. Now, every country cannot have a strong immigration policy. The country, some will, some need to sort of make up for, for a weak population demographic profile with productivity, with technology. I mean, a lot of the reason some of these new labor-saving technologies come along is because they're responses to the challenges of demographic difficulties. Most of the population growth in the world is coming from the lower and middle-income countries. So thus, global supply chains, because if the industrialized world, isn't quite in the long-term position to provide the labor force for certain things, certainly the developing world, which has a different demographic profile, is. So, the answer is yes, Germany, the United States, the United Kingdom, they need family planning, they need immigration policies, they need a lot of things, but all the more reason, it gets it back to the beginning of our discussion, to say, okay, even with that, an advanced country is going to have demographic challenges, but, emerging countries are not. Africa has a terrific demographic profile. Gee, maybe I ought to think about what Africa can do for my supply chain. So, you need to both, in terms of dealing with the demographic challenge that is, sweeping the industrialized world, they have to sort of think both inward and outward.
Well, let's talk about Africa for a moment, because that's come up in a couple of our shows. We have had on an economist that said that Africa really is kind of ripe for the picking, because that a lot of Africa was governed by the British for so many years. They speak English, they're well-educated, it seems to be a younger population set. How is Africa developing? Because I don't think a lot of people are looking at that.
Well, Africa, the sun is beginning to rise over Africa. It is still a small part of the global economy. In terms of percentages, you're not dealing with something large, but you may be dealing with something that is emerging. It's the second fastest growing region in the world. Its civil wars have calmed down. It still has many, many problems. We see terrorism there. We see Ebola there. Let's not kid ourselves. But, it's in a better position for growth, and as a result, it's had much stronger growth. There's in certain spotty areas, we're starting to see the strong growth morph into greater manufacturing activity. There's evidence of manufacturing activity really rising, for example, in Africa's largest country, which is Nigeria. So there are hints that Africa is starting to emerge in both in terms of economic growth and, if not widely dispersed manufacturing growth, then interesting manufacturing growth in certain countries of Africa. So, it's a young population, speaking of demographics. It's well-positioned. There's a port kind of area, particularly South Africa. And global manufacturers should take a look at it, may find it interesting. It's an emerging population there that is getting into, in spite of the well-known many challenges, that is getting into some interesting markets that could evolve for them.
Cliff, on the Made in the USA issue, kind of as a wrap-up as we hit the end of the show here, and we appreciate you being our guest, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners on that topic?
I think everybody has to think global, whether you are, a small mom-and-pop business or working for a multinational Leviathan, you have to think global. The world matters to you. Even if you only have a market, let's say, in one or two countries, Mexico, Canada, or just within the United States, even if your markets are only in the United States, global issues matter to you. So that's my final word. Everybody in any business, small or large, domestic or local, or domestic or international, everybody's got to think global. And you cannot shut the world out of your business thinking.
Thanks, Cliff. We really appreciate you being a guest on the show.
My pleasure.
Lou, I'm sorry, you have another comment there?
Yeah, I do. Cliff, I appreciate you coming on the show. It's always interesting and insightful. And we will have this show rebroadcast in about an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours, on our website at mfgtalkradio.com. Chris, if you would give us your address, I'd appreciate that for our listeners. Cliff?
My email address?
Your website address.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. It's www.mapi.net.
Okay. Thank you.
MAPI.net. Great site. A lot of great
MAPI.net.
Okay.
Thank you. It was a pleasure being with you.
Thank you very much, and we'll have you again on, I'm sure.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Cliff. And that wraps us up for Manufacturing Talk Radio today. We have certainly enjoyed having Cliff Waldman being our guest. By the way, you can follow us on Twitter at MFG Talk Radio. And we tweet frequently about what's happening on the show, either upcoming guests and shows or what just happened on the show. And we will be both rebroadcasting the show, and it's always available as a podcast at mfgtalkradio.com. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and we'll be back with you again next week.
Thanks for joining us on Manufacturing Talk Radio. You can hear our next broadcast each Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time at mfgtalkradio.com.